It's time for Security Now with Steve Gibson. Leah Laporte's out this week. I, Jason Howe, will be filling his shoes as best as I can anyway. Steve's going to talk about a whole number of things, but he's going to dive pretty deep on a newly revealed flaw in the Bluetooth wireless protocol. Is this something to be concerned with or not? Steve's going to tell you all about it next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 674, recorded Tuesday, July 31st, 2018. Attacking Bluetooth pairing. This episode of Security Now is brought to you by MoogSoft. Reduce IT alerts and tickets by up to 90% guaranteed. Visit MoogSoft.com to learn more and sign up for a demo. It's time for Security Now, the show where we talk about all the latest security news happening throughout the course of each and every week. I'm a new voice on the show because Leo's normally sitting in this seat, but, you know, I'm not the person you're tuning in to listen to and to watch. It's Steve Gibson, the man, the myth, the legend. How you doing, Steve?
Hey, Jason. It's great to be working with you this week. Absolutely. Leo, I guess, is off on a little quick 3-day trip, but as I noted to you before we began recording, I saw him also pre-recording content for his weekend show, and we just learned from John that he's pretty much gone all of September. So you and I will be working together, I guess, at least probably for 3 of the shows in September.
I think it's probably 3 episodes during the time, yep, that he's gone. I could be wrong that there may be a 4th in there, but I'm pretty positive it's the 3.
And I guess Father Robert is back briefly in August, which starts tomorrow, since this is July 31st, and then he's gone forever. So.
Yeah, I mean, gone forever. That sounds so ominous. Gone forever from Twit until who knows what happens down the line, I suppose. But yeah, that's true. I know he's back sometime in August, and he's going to swing by. Not entirely sure how deep he's going to get when he swings by, but
right.
Oh, he'll be on Twit. Okay, so he's going to be appearing on Twit when he swings by. And I think saw in last week's episode that you've got kind of the whole squirrel thing happening. There was a plan to do something in tandem with Father Robert at some point, right?
Well, and I'm planning to use you now instead.
Oh, all righty.
I am, because where I am is I've mentioned to Leo, and we'll be talking about this a little bit later, because in the context of Google's announcement of the Titan security keys, we'll be covering on the podcast, where I am is that because there's no way, you know, GRC has sort of off the beaten path news groups, old school text only NNTP, you know, like Usenet style news groups, where like everything happens on the development front. And it's a really great place for people who are willing to sacrifice the convenience of a web interface and willing to set up a specific client for that. I mean, there's a bar you have to get over, but that's not practical for something that, you know, like a technology like Squirrel is meant to be, that are all of our spouses and friends and family and so forth would be using. So the point is that I have needed standard, easy to use web forums. Those exist, but I built them. I chose a really nice forum package, Zenforo, which is in its second major version release. And those are the guys who previously did vBulletin, I think it was. So, I mean, they really know their stuff. But it naturally doesn't support Squirrel authentication. It doesn't know about Squirrel authentication. So I'm right now in the process of teaching it about Squirrel, so that, because you have to be able to use Squirrel to log into the Squirrel forums. That would be crazy.
I would imagine if you did anything different, yeah, people would be holding your feet to the fire on that one.
Yeah. So anyway, so that's where I am. But my intention is to sit down with you, Leo, and I was thinking maybe, I'm blanking on his name, the guy who's traveling around and eating everything in foreign countries.
Oh, Mike Elgin.
Mike, yes, because I want to sort of do it as a as a presentation, but also sort of contentious, where like you guys say, okay, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? What about this? Because I think that would be most useful to people who are themselves saying and thinking, well, what about this? What about this? Because the point is, I think there that the squirrel system has an answer to every possible question. And so, I mean, that's what it has to have. And so that makes it unique among all the identity solutions that exist. And I think that's the proper way to like vet it to our audience. So anyway, I don't know when that's going to happen, because I never know when anything is going to happen. But as soon as we're ready, we'll find a time and we'll make that happen.
So, absolutely. Yeah. And count me in. That sounds like a lot of fun. I'd be happy to help.
So in the meantime, however, we've got episode 674 for this last day of July, the 31st. There were two topics vying for the title. There is the news of a new attack on Bluetooth, which generated a lot of press last week, which we couldn't ignore. And then there's also, believe it or not, another Spectre processor speculation attack, which, of course, has been the gift that just keeps on giving to this podcast all year.
Yeah, no kidding. It's like a constant feed of information for you to talk about, basically.
Yeah, and there's a lot to say about both. And so it's like, and then I just thought, okay, we'll make attacking Bluetooth pairing the title, only because I'm tired of typing Spectre into the title of the podcast. And I'm sure our listeners are like, oh, not another one. But we got to talk about that. So we'll talk about Spectre first, look at a new trend in botnets, which I'm calling flash botnets, because they're able to now, by leveraging old, well-known vulnerabilities, they're able to flash into existence in a matter of hours. There's a new one called the death botnet. We've also got some interesting stuff about the security of DoD websites. There's a bunch of Google Chrome news. One particular U.S. Senator, Ron Wyden, has been pushing both the DoD, which we'll talk about, and also the government in general towards more security. We've got some interesting bit about the emergence of and the threat of cloned websites, which could easily slip under people's radar unless they're watching for them. And so I want to put that on everyone's radar. Some more cryptocurrency mining bans, the announcement last week of Google's Titan hardware security dongles. And then we'll finish by talking about the technology in enough detail of this newly discovered Bluetooth protocol flaw to put it into context for our listeners and figure out whether, even though the OS and device manufacturers are actually all scrambling to update their implementations, whether we as end users really have anything to worry about now, you know, then and even now before they get things updated. So I think another typical great Security Now podcast.
Awesome. I can't wait. Looking forward to it. And you mentioned Spectre kind of at the top, so that seems like the great place to start.
Yes.
It's always evolving. What is NetSpectre exactly?
Okay. So you can imagine from the name that that sort of gives it away. A couple weeks ago, we talked about something kind of related, which was a Rowhammer attack. D-hammer or DRAN hammering or Rowhammering is something we've also been talking about now for a couple years. It turns out that the dynamic memory in all of our devices, laptops, desktops, and even smartphones, Android has been a subject of hammering attacks. The DRAM is susceptible to noise like adjacent row noise, because DRAM memory is organized in rows and columns. And if you read frequently from one row, it turns out that there's a probability, it's low but not zero, that a bit will flip in the adjacent row. And clever attackers, or actually at this point, clever academicians, researchers, have figured out how to leverage that into an attack, to like arrange to flip the write permission bit on the memory that governs the memory manager to give their process write access to the kernel, for example, where it should only ever have read access. So anyway, so what happened a couple weeks ago, we talked about this, is the guys who have been doing all this Rowhammer research at VU Amsterdam, Herbert Boss and his team, have come up with a new attack called Throwhammer, which is over the network. Because it turns out that network adapters have gotten so fast that they've had to be able to do DMA, direct memory access, into their buffer memory, because they need super high bandwidth connectivity. Well, that turns out to be Rowhammerable, and so thus Throwhammer. So first we had network-based Rowhammer attacks. Now we have network-based Spectre attacks. It turns out that in this case, I had it in my notes, but I don't see it here. A pair of researchers figured out how to use the network activity on many different systems. They use desktops and laptops, and even cloud-based VM systems, to induce Spectre speculation vulnerabilities. What they said in their abstract was, and this is a little bit of this is repetitive, but again, they sum it so nicely. They said speculative execution is a crucial cornerstone to the performance of modern processors. During speculative execution, the processor may perform operations the program usually would not perform, while the architectural effects and results of such operations are discarded. If the speculative execution is aborted, microarchitectural side effects may remain. Thus, you know, and this is the whole idea of like training a branch predictor for a certain prediction and then causing it to deliberately mispredict. Well, nothing at the architectural level sees that, but because that's a microarchitectural optimization, which all processors have incorporated. Anyway, they continue. The recently published Spectre attacks exploit these side effects to read memory contents of other programs. However, Spectre attacks require some form of local code execution on the target system. And in fact, in discussing this on the podcast, it's one of the reasons I've said to our listeners, certainly this is of concern in a cloud environment where multiple VMs might be owned by different organizations. One of them could be untrustworthy, and they're running on shared hardware, because there you've got code from a third party that essentially is sharing the same processor, and that's where the leakage can occur. On an individual's, like an end user's machine, well, if you've got bad stuff running in your system in order to perform Spectre manipulation, well, you've already got problems because your system has got malware on it. So, and frankly, there are easier ways to break privacy if malware is running on a system, probably than relying on Spectre. So it's less of an issue. Anyway, so they said Spectre attacks require some form of local code execution on the target system. Hence, systems where an attacker cannot run any code at all were until now thought to be safe. And that's the key, is that in mitigating these attacks, because mitigation costs performance. That is, we have speculation in our processors because it is a powerful optimization win. So if you have to turn off speculation, you want to turn it off selectively to minimize the performance impact. Thus, it's only been turned off so far where it's been clear that it's necessary to turn it off. What these guys have done by demonstrating that just network activity is able to leak information, that is, believe it or not, the timing of the return packets, when enough of them are looked at over time, allows them to dribble bits of reliably dribble bits at a low rate out of a system to which they have network access. So that says they're not running any code on the system. So this changes the universe of mitigation for Spectre attacks significantly. These guys did report their discovery to Intel in March. And at this point, Intel's probably just like thinking, when is this nightmare going to end? So they said, in this paper, we present NetSpectre, a generic remote Spectre variant 1 attack. For this purpose, we demonstrate the first access-driven remote cache attack over network leaking, and this doesn't sound like much, but we'll talk about this, 15 bits per hour. Beyond, again, slow. That's why I called it a dribble. Right. But what the reason this is significant is that it can be going on as long as it needs to because it's over the network. So, it can be going on behind someone's back, and how would they know? They said, beyond retrofitting existing attacks to a network scenario, we also demonstrate the first Spectre attack which does not use a cache covert channel. In other words, normally they're looking for cache, whether data is in cache or not, and sensing the delay required to fetch from main memory as opposed to the much faster access from cache. Anyway, they found some instructions in the Intel processor, the AVX instructions, which give them a cache-free Spectre attack and allow them to get substantially more, four times, 60 bits per hour from the target system. So again, this is just them being a little more academic and seeing what they can do. They said, we verified that our NetSpectre attacks work in local area networks as well as between virtual machines in the Google Cloud. And finally, they said, NetSpectre marks a paradigm shift from local attacks to remote attacks, exposing a much wider range and large number of devices to Spectre attacks. Spectre attacks now must also be considered on devices which do not run any potential attacker-controlled code at all. Like, can you say IoT? Mm-hmm. They say, we show that especially in this remote scenario, attacks based on weaker gadgets, gadgets is the term in the Spectre literature for some code which they arrange to use to leak the information. So attacks based on weaker gadgets which do not leak actual data are still very powerful to break address space layout randomization remotely. So that's the other thing they've done. Address space layout randomization, ASLR, this is a mitigation we often talk about, because the idea is that one of the more powerful attacks is so-called return-oriented programming, where if you are unable to execute your own code, for example, in a buffer overflow, you can still arrange to execute existing code. That is, you jump into the tail of a subroutine which does a few things you need and then returns to you. So it's called return-oriented programming. And the point is to do that. Oh, and that's like code in the kernel. So as long as you know where code of the various kernel modules are located, you can jump to little like prearranged spots in order to have it do little bits of work for you, come back, jump somewhere else, do a little bit more, and end up building a potent exploit out of by just, you know, like using little snippets of code that already exists. But you have to know where it is, because it's a blind attack. There's no way you can check beforehand. So the mitigation for that has been to scramble around, that is address space layout randomization, to randomize where things are loaded every time a modern OS boots. The modules that form the OS are all randomized in their locations. So the point is that these guys have also demonstrated that even if they're unable to find a information leak where they actually read out memory contents, they are still able to de-randomize the address space layout randomization remotely. So that could be like the beginning of an attack on a system that is not rebooted frequently, since rebooting would re-randomize the address space layout. Anyway, so that's the nature of what they've done. The popular press in covering this, I think, got it wrong, because the approach that the press took was, well, 15 bits per hour, that's really not so fast. It's like, okay, wait a minute. The fact that it's a slow dribble of information by no means renders this ineffective. So, for example, imagine the scenario where some malware gets on an employee's machine through a phishing attack inside of an enterprise, and we've seen that before. Then the question is, what mischief can the malware get up to? Well, normally intranet servers are going to be hardened against their own internal network, just as they are hardened against the external network. So if something gets onto an intranet and is then able to use NetSpector to overnight, I think I figured it takes 17 hours for on a LAN to obtain a 256-bit private key from a server. So that's not that long.
That's,
I mean,
not
15
insignificant
hours
at all. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Running behind the backs of a system, if it's then able to determine what somebody's private key or the private key on a corporate intranet LAN, then that's powerful. And they did also verify among Google separate instances of a server running in the Google Cloud, there is plenty of bandwidth between cloud servers that they were able to attack another server running on Google Cloud and obtain the same kind of rate of information. So this is something that definitely needs to be looked at. They said toward the end of their write-up on leakage, they said, then to give our listeners a sense for like how much is necessary, they said desktop and laptop computers, in contrast to local Spectre attacks, where a single measurement can be sufficient, NetSpector attacks require a large number of measurements to distinguish bits with sufficient confidence. Even on a local network, around 100,000 measurements are required to reduce the noise to a level where a difference between bits can be clearly seen. By repeating the attack, the noise is reduced, making it easier to distinguish the bits. They said for our local attack, we had a gigabit connection between the victim and the attacker, a typical scenario in local networks, but also for network connections of dedicated servers and virtual servers. we measured a standard deviation of the network latency of 15.6 microseconds. So they said, and they talk about breaking ASLR. They said to break ASLR, address space layout randomization, we require the cache covert channel. On average, this allows breaking the randomization remotely within 2 hours. So that's not bad. And on a cloud network, they said we evaluated the performance in the cloud using two virtual machines instances on the Google Cloud. These virtual machines have a fast network connection. We configured the two machines to each use two virtual CPUs, which enabled a 4 gig per second connection. In this setup, we repeat the measurement 20 million times per bit to get an error-free leakage of bytes. On average, leaking one byte takes 8 hours for the cache covert channel and 3 hours for the AVX covert channel. They said while this is comparatively slow, it shows that remote Spectre attacks are feasible between independent instances in the public cloud. In particular, they said APTs, advanced persistent threats, typically run for several weeks or months. Such an extended time frame is clearly sufficient to leak sensitive data, such as encryption keys or passwords, using the NetSpectre attack in a cloud environment. So, and then I here's where I did the math that I quoted before in the notes. I said a 256-bit secret key on a local network at the rate of 4 minutes per bit, or 10,024 minutes, is 17 hours. So entirely feasible. However, what they're doing is they are sending packets to the server and getting a reply. They are their only instrumentation. That is what they're, the only thing they're able to sense is the timing of the reply. So what that does say is this is completely infeasible over the internet. It is only within a locally contained cloud environment where you've essentially got the equivalent of an intranet in the cloud among servers, or on a corporate LAN. So it's got to be point to point between the network interface, which is making the requests, and the network interface that is being probed. There is absolutely, given how many packets were required to obtain a bit of information with a LAN or in a virtual network environment between VMs, there is absolutely no way this could possibly produce information over the internet, where you've got multiple jumps with routers, all buffering packets and introducing huge amounts of delay. I mean, they're looking at a standard deviation of 15.6 microseconds. That's the kind of timing they need. So with a standard deviation of 15.6 microseconds, they're still needing hundreds of thousands of packets per bit. So as we know, on the internet, we readily see timing of 30, 40, 50 milliseconds and huge variations. So a huge standard deviation. So there's absolutely no way this is feasible for a remote attacker, for example, to attack someone's, Soho router, which has a public face. But this should be a serious concern, both in cloud computing scenarios and also on LANs, because as we said, you could spend a day. What attacker wouldn't be happy to pound on a LAN accessible server for 17 hours if it meant that they could get that server's 256-bit elliptic curve private key. So
absolutely.
Yet another mess that speculation brings us.
It seems to me like this is the perfect kind of example of the slow and steady approach, right? Slow and steady wins the race. It doesn't matter how much you're pulling. What matters is that the plan works even over a long period of time at low amounts of data. Like there's still something to be gained from that. It's very easy to kind of consider it a theoretical sort of thing and invaluable to an attacker. But obviously there's something to be gained there. And a day's really not that much time in the grand scheme of things.
No, not if you've got something, you know, like, well, not when you consider the value you're getting in return.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you get a server's private keys, you're able to spoof its identity. So, yeah. I mean, that's the private key is the most protected thing that a server has, because that's how it's signing all of its outgoing traffic. So, yeah. I think that what we're going to need to see, as we've said, is short term, kind of hold our breath. It's important to remember too, all of this Spectre stuff is speculative. That is, in terms of it even being it's theoretical. Mm-hmm. There's never been an instance found of this being done in the wild. We know that it's possible, and we know that what's possible ends up happening. So what you know, essentially what everyone's been doing is to make this as improbable and as low leverage, that is generally the Spectre flaws, as possible. Ultimately, we're just going to have to learn a lesson and come up with another redesign of chips that recognize that we need to isolate the micro architecture speculation from the top level architecture, so so we can still get the performance that we want from speculation, but that nobody is able to sense that out at the top level. So we get the isolation that we thought we always had, but it turns out that was always an illusion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you kind of touched a little bit on IoT in there, and it looks like it's such an ominous name, Death Botnet. Who's the person that selects this, and why was that not taken already? Because that seems like an obvious one.
So last week, there's a security researcher with New Sky Security, Ankit, and I always trip over his name. It looks like Ankit Anabhav, and I'll just call him Ankit
A.
so that I'm not mangling his last name. Yeah. So last week he brought us the notion of what I called a flash botnet, because it had acquired 18,000 Huawei routers within 24 hours. That is, from the moment it started. A day later, it had 18,000 routers in its net. Wow. And it was using a several year old vulnerability that had long since been known, that Huawei had issued a patch for. But, you know, these are routers. These are things in people's closets, or, you know, they're like they're just sitting there minding their own business. Well, not so much now. But, you know, the point is that they had not been updated. And this is the problem that we're really seeing now with routers, because that's just – it's now become just the playland for hackers, because it's now – all hackers know that routers are not being updated for the most part with the latest patches. So they just go and look at a two-year-old patch and go, let's find out who's vulnerable. Well, Ankit found – For this week's update on, you know, this week in compromised routers, he found another botnet, which its author calls the Death Botnet for, you know, who knows why. He fired up a dialogue with the hacker who goes by the handle Elite Lands. ELITELANDS. So Elite Lands named this new botnet Death. So far, it has not attacked anybody, so it hasn't done anything, although it's going after AV tech-based devices, which include DVRs, network video recorders, IP cameras, and more. Once again, using a two-year-old and also long-since patch-available device flaw. But this one is a little bizarre, believe it or not. It turns out that the AV tech devices expose their password in the clear. So the password is available in plain text. So it's easy for someone to scan them, hack into the device to get the password in order to log in. Beyond that, it turns out that, believe it or not, the password process has a flaw such that the whatever is used in the password ends up being a command sent to the shell. I mean, it's just hard to believe this. So, for example, if you set the username to "this is my username" with the password of "reboot," it reboots the device after having performed that. So Ankit told Bleeping Computer, who had their reporting of this, he says, "If I put reboot as the password, the AV tech system gets rebooted." And he said, of course, the Death botnet is doing much more than just rebooting. Ankit says the hacker has been experimenting with different payloads for use in the password field, meaning that, you know, what we're talking about is a shell command. Mm-hmm. That is a command, any command executed that you choose in the password field. So Ankit said that he's recently started using these payloads to build a botnet, to which he refers to as Death. So in the latest version of the payload, Ankit says that Elite Lands is adding accounts with a lifespan of only 5 minutes that execute his payload and then disappear from the infected device. So Ankit said it's like a burner account, because usually people don't set up passwords for access of only 5 minutes. But in this case, that's enough to get the job done. That essentially commandeers the device and gets it to join into the botnet. And then the account which he used is transient, and so it expires off of the device and can no longer be used. So 1,200 AV tech devices are hijackable in this way, which Ankit determined using a readily available IoT search engine. I don't know if it's Shodan or one of the other ones. But anyway, this was patched more than a year and a half ago. But as we've said, these devices don't actually tend to be patched in the real world. Their users just, you know, it's an IP camera or a DVR or a net video recorder. And so, you know, if it's not broken, don't fix it.
The person who owns it would have to know first of all to jump on there and do some sort of a manual firmware update in order to get that.
Right. Right.
They're not going to do that. That's the big problem with IoT at this point. No one's going to do that.
Exactly. And as we've said, we have to move to a model where these non-maintained devices are able to update themselves.
Yes.
We have to have that. And then it'll just have to be, we'll just have to wait around for the devices which don't know how to update themselves to finally just die off, to age out of the ecosystem and be replaced by, you know, solid state network recorders that hopefully will know how to update themselves. But, you know, that's what we have to do, is have self-updating, you know, self-healing devices. I mean, we already have that with our web browsers. all of our web browsers are now updating themselves. We, as we know, our OSs are, albeit with a little more user interaction, but you know, Windows 10 has been controversial because it's been so heavy-handed in forcing people, ultimately forcing them to update the OS. So you just don't have a choice at some point, if you're going to be connected to the internet. So it's going to have to be that our IoT devices take that same responsibility moving forward, and then we just wait for the ones that don't to die off.
Yeah, because we can't be trusted. That's what we've learned at this point. We cannot be trusted to protect ourselves.
It's really that we're learning that all of these devices, I mean, unfortunately, all of them have vulnerabilities, which emerge after they've been shipped, and that users...
Well after, yeah.
Yes, and that users just treat them as appliances.
Yes.
It's a plug it in and don't think about it again until it breaks. They're happy with it. I mean, that would be the other thing to do, would be to like build in a deliberate breakage into the devices so that it's like it dies after 3 years, although then you'd have all kinds of other, you know, legal issues.
Yeah, so, I think people would be upset about that too. I mean, but that's the huge issue with IoT as our homes. You know, I don't think of my home as like incredibly smart. I mean, there's smart devices, but if I went into my Eero app and added up all the devices that were connecting, like there's tons of them, even though I don't think that there are, which, you know, and I'm pretty tuned into technology. If somebody has a decent amount of these devices and they're just not thinking about updating them, like it's so untenable to think I'm going to go over to all my devices every month and make sure that they're updated, you know? So it's got to be on the device side. It's got to happen automatically.
Yep. Yep.
As it gets more and more complex.
Yep.
Yeah.
So we have a senator who is often in the news because I have to say he's on top of things. He's Oregon's Senator Ron Wyden. And he's probably a pain in the government's rear end, but
yes.
it's a pain that we need him to be. 2 months ago, Ron wrote a letter to the Department of Defense. He addressed it to Dana Deasy, who's the Chief Information Officer, so the CIO at the U.S. Department of Defense at the Pentagon. The letter reads, "Dear Mr. Deasy, I write to ask that you take immediate action to require the adoption of," and get this, I mean, it's hard to believe that this letter it had to be written in the first place, "that you take immediate action to require the adoption of cybersecurity best practices on all publicly accessible DOD, Department of Defense, web services. In 2015, right, so 3 years ago, the Office of Management and Budget issued memo M-15-13 requiring all federal agencies to take steps to secure their websites and other web services, including interfaces for automated programmatic interaction, APIs, from cyber attacks. The OMB memo gave agencies," okay, so this was in 2015, "gave agencies until the end of 2016 to enable HTTPS encryption and to enforce its use with HTTP strict transport security, that is HSTS, which ensures web browsers will not use insecure protocols when connecting to HSTS-enabled websites." So, okay, in the first place, this is very cool that a senator is like knows what this is. Maybe his staff. But at least, you know, but we know from Ron in the past that, you know, he's savvy to this stuff. He then says, in 2017, okay, after the OMB letter of 2015 gave the federal agencies until the end of 2016 to do this, in 2017, Ron writes, the Department of Homeland Security issued Binding Operational Directive, BOD 18-01, reiterating the OMB requirements and requiring civilian agencies to adopt additional forms of basic cyber hygiene. He says a small number of DOD websites, including the Army, Air Force, and national security agencies, you know, NSA, right? Okay, so we would hope, currently implement HTTPS by default, a small number, and use certificates trusted by major web browsers. Unfortunately, many other sites, including the Navy, Marines, and your own office's website at dodcio.defense.gov, either do not secure connections with encryption. Now, this was 2 months ago, right? Now, deep into 2018. Either do not secure connections with encryption, or get this, only prove their authenticity using a certificate issued by the DOD Root Certificate Authority, which, okay, and then he says, I won't editorialize, I'll continue reading, which he says, many mainstream web browsers do not consider these DOD certificates trustworthy and issue scary security warnings that users are forced to navigate before accessing the website's information. These challenges do not only impact civilians, service members accessing DOD pages from home regularly encounter security warnings and must click through such errors when accessing public DOD resources. So in other words, to the degree that they did implement TLS encryption and authentication through HTTPS, they did so with some random root, some random certificate signed by the DOD root that isn't publicly trusted. Unbelievable.
So then what's the point? I'm very surprised that attention to this, and I'm curious why what has motivated Ron Wyden to get so involved with all aspects like this, but surprised that attention hasn't been given to this before. This seems like no-brainer stuff.
I know. And so what happened was, this was prompted by Wyden's awareness of what was going to be happening with Chrome. The letter continues, the DOD cannot continue these insecure practices. Starting in July, and we'll be talking about this in a minute, we've been speaking of it before, of course, the Google Chrome browser, and I'll editorialize here, noting that it is the majority browser on the internet, will begin warning visitors of non-HTTPS sites that the requested site is not secure. These warnings will erode the public's trust in the department and its ability to defend against sophisticated cyber threats, you know, or your mother. He didn't say that. Moreover, the DOD's refusal to implement cybersecurity best practices actively degrades the public's security by teaching users to treat critical security warnings as irrelevant.
That's a really good point.
Normalizing these warnings increases the risk of cybercrime and foreign government hacking as users, both military and civilian, incorporate these dangerous practices reinforced by the DOD into their daily habits. You see, he finishes, DOD has prided itself on cybersecurity leadership, and now is the time to again demonstrate that leadership. I urge you to direct all DOD agencies and offices to take the following. I was going to interrupt myself just saying, you know, everybody else has to take the following three concrete steps to improve cybersecurity of their publicly accessible web services. First, adhere to all guidelines specified in that OMB memo M1513 and the subsequent DHS Binding Operational Directive 1801, including enable HTTPS with HSTS on all public web services, facilitate the adoption of HSTS by delivering a list of all public DoD domains, including .mil addresses, to DHS as required by the DHS BOD. Obtain and deploy certificates, imagine this, trusted by major web browsers for all web services accessible to the general public, and evaluate the use of shorter-lived machine-generated certificates, such as those available at no cost from organizations like Let's Encrypt. There I would argue that if you're going to do this, you know, get your certs from, you know, EV certs from DigiCert, and, you know, go with the best, and you know, you're going to bite the bullet, then inspire as much confidence as possible, because why not? And he says, please provide me an action plan. So this was 2 months ago. This was in May he sent this. So by July 20th, 2018, describing your progress implementing these steps and detailing an estimated date by which all publicly accessible DoD web services will implement these cybersecurity best practices. If you have any questions regarding this request, please contact Chris Shogian.
Segoyan, I think.
Segoyan, that's it. Chris Segoyan in my office. So it's significant that Chris is there in Ron's office, or accessible through Ron at least. Mm-hmm. So the good news is they did reply. They said, the DOD did reply last week. So around the, by, you know, close to, if not by the deadline, saying, quote, we've been working on it for 2 years, and we plan to have this done by the end of the year. So, okay.
Celebrate.
In the meantime, Chrome 68 and subsequent did execute on its intention of flagging non-HTTPS sites as, not secure. That is happening as of last week, when 68, when, you know, emerged from beta and became the version that everyone is using. You know, and for what it's worth, the DoD is not alone. According to Cloudflare's telemetry, more than half of the top 1 million sites, 542,605 of the top 1 million sites, do not use or do not redirect users to an HTTPS version of the HTTP URL. In other words, while they may have support for HTTPS, if you enter the site with HTTP, you stay there. And of course, that's a problem. That's not promoting the user to the secure version. It means you go in either way and you get to remain. So what this means is that starting with the release of Chrome 68, a large number of users will see, if they happen to HTTP, a not secure indicator next to most of the sites they visit after they update to Chrome 68. And I've said before, and I still don't know why it's not happening, that our browsers really should start attempting an HTTPS connection when not otherwise forced to HTTP. So, for example, you know, traditionally, if you just put in www.something.com, the browser defaults to HTTP. They really should start flipping that and defaulting to HTTPS.
I mean, is there a reason that they don't? I use a Chrome plugin called HTTPS everywhere, and so yes, that kind of forces that behavior. But why don't they do that? Because that seems like, it seems like the right direction to go. More secure down to less secure if more secure doesn't exist.
Yes, it is. And it's just inertia. It's just that there's a concern that it might break some things. Oh. But, you know, but that's becoming decreasingly probable. And I did some Googling just because I was curious what effect the appearance of this not secure indicator would have. I heard Leo on the weekend. I thought I heard him grumbling about it, like he was annoyed that Chrome had done this because I guess it was upsetting people. Maybe he had some calls on his tech guy show over the weekend. I'm not sure what the backstory is, and I'll ask him, to elaborate next week. But in Googling, I ran across an instance of somebody posting in the Google forum their upset that FoxNews.com was now showing not secure, and that did not make them happy. So I thought, wow, really? So I went over and I put in www.fox, or maybe it was just foxnews.com, and sure enough, it took me to http://www.foxnews.com, and in Chrome, not secure. And then I was curious, so I added an S, HTTPS, and that worked fine too. And now Chrome was not saying that it was not secure. It wasn't super happy. I mean, there was no, it wasn't an EV cert, so it didn't light up green, but I checked the certificate at https://www.foxnews.com, and it was a perfectly valid certificate issued by DigiCert. So, and then what was interesting was they had a little I next to the left of the URL, and for information. So I clicked on that, and even though it was HTTPS, that is in the HTTPS version, everything was okay. I got a red warning saying your connection to this site is not fully secure. And then in black underneath it said you should not enter any sensitive information on this site. For example, passwords or credit cards, because it could be stolen by attackers. So I thought, oh, what? So again, dug in some more, and I found some dialogue about this from people. I might have been in the same thread, because there was like some back and forth grumbliness about Fox News showing as not secure, and Google finally stepped in and said, hi all. The reason why https://www.foxnews.com is getting marked not fully secure is because it includes a search form that sends data to http://www.foxnews.com. And he says, note the insecure HTTP. We currently count that as not fully secure and downgrade the security indicator icon to the I symbol rather than the lock. A secure HTTPS site should load all resources over HTTPS and have all forms submit to HTTPS. If you have any questions about this policy or our current implementation of it, feel free to follow up in this thread. So, and what's interesting is that, GRC has been historically accessible both ways. I did quite a while ago, years ago, switched over to HSTS and preloaded GRC.com and www.grc.com in Chrome as a known HTTPS only site, so that would be the only way that Chrome users could connect. And that list has been propagated since. But you can in a site's URLs, you can just leave the HTTP:// off and just do /www.foxnews.com. And then any URLs on that page inherit the security of the containing page, so that if the page is HTTPS, then all of the non-specific links get upgraded to that.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Although what you really want to do is just, it's time to like for everybody to switch over. So anyway, I just wanted to give some more detailed coverage because a lot of people are going to be seeing either not secure or this not fully secure. And, you know, people are squawking, but this transition cannot have caught anyone by surprise. Google has deliberately signaled the plans to do this for more than a couple years, well in advance, to website admins, all whom had ample time to migrate their sites to fully secure connections. I mean, maybe they just want to be stubborn and they don't want to, but clearly that's not the case for Fox News. They've got a good DigiCert certificate. They just haven't gone the final step of moving HTTP. If they've got the cert, HTTP accesses should simply redirect. I mean, that's like one line in the Apache server config in order to redirect the user to the same URL, but with S at the end of HTTP. That's trivial. Just do it. And then it's clear that they need to go in and remove some older HTTPs within the content of the page, like that search form, and switch it over to HTTPS. So anyway, Google tends to lead by having people kicking and screaming, but leading by example and getting people to make these changes. Nobody's ever happy with it, but this is what it takes. And so I'm sure there will be people who will, this puts pressure on sites to decide what they want to do. Maybe somebody wants to be stubborn and just stay HTTP. It's certainly their right to do so. But it is true that the site is not secured. It doesn't really mean it's not secure, but, I understand what Google is doing. So,
I mean, not only is the site not secured, and sure, that's up to the site owner to make that determination, but no matter what, going forward, anyone using Google Chrome to navigate to that site is going to be presented with this big, scary red screen. This is what Google's move in this regard was all about, right? Like, yes, they signaled it far in advance. They gave people ample warning, but even Google knew that there was going to be an insane number of sites that weren't going to do the work to update to this. And they know that people are going to squawk and be upset when they try and visit their favorite website and they're presented with this, and that the website owner isn't going to like it. But they did it anyways because they know that in the long run, the end game is that more of these sites are going to switch over, even kicking and screaming. But eventually they will, because they aren't going to, sacrifice the potential of their site, losing traffic or whatever, because people are scared of it now.
Well, and they would arguably not switch unless there was some pressure on them.
Absolutely.
And as you said, I mean, again, more than half of the top 1 million sites right now, 542,605, are not pushing people to HTTPS when the site supports both. They're allowing people to come in under with HTTP. So, if they've got bookmarks with HTTP, they just keep using that entry because that's the default, because the site doesn't bounce them over to the secure version. So, and we also know that Google's not done. This is the Chrome 68 step. Downstream, this gets more scary. It gets red with a slash through it if sites don't get this, Yeah. Don't take the hint at this point. So it's not over yet.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there were some other cool features. I won't go into them in detail that also were dropped with Chrome 68. Most of them were for developer side enhancements. Some CSS enhancements and WebRTC got some upgrades. But they did also add the Web Payments API, which has been evolving over time. The intention of the Web Payments API is to provide essentially standardize through the W3C an API for purchasing stuff, so that users who purchase through their web browsers, as so many of us do now, will be able to use, where sites support it, a unified experience for purchasing. So that's one thing that I expect users to see. The one thing that is still a puzzle for me is that we were supposed to get this strict site isolation feature in Chrome 68, and I got Chrome 68 now, and it's still off. So I don't know why. I talked about it a couple of weeks ago. Leo brought up Chrome that was supposed to have it. And if you put in the URL, Chrome:// flags, then you search for ISOL as the first four letters of isolation. That brings up a selection of instances of settings, and they're all like the main site isolation for me yesterday when I double checked again was still disabled.
Yeah, mine's disabled right now as well.
Yeah, and we keep hearing that it's enabled for almost all users, and I'm thinking almost all who? I don't know where that, you know, where that is, but you know, it's very cool because it deeply sandboxes the rendering of cross domain rendering with like, so it breaks even one page. It's not just a page per process. Now it's a domain per process to further insulate domains from each other. Potentially expensive in terms of resources on the client system on the client machine, but so much stronger that Chrome is Google is looking at backing out of their Spectre mitigations because they believe that this per domain isolation, when it's available, if it's ever available, will be really useful. So we'll see.
I just activated it myself and then restarted my, because I'm on Chrome OS, restarted the entire computer and then realized that's a horrible idea during a show. When I do these things, it usually means I messed something up along the way. But thankfully, everything's all back up. So we're good to go. So now I have it. So thank you for that tip. Hey, we've got more. We've got a lot more, obviously. We're going to talk a little bit more about more of what Ron Wyden has up his sleeve, and that relates to Flash.
One more thing he's pushing. Yes.
Yeah, totally. I love it. That's great. But before we do, let's take a quick break and thank the sponsor of this episode of Security Now. This episode is brought to you by Moogsoft. IT people know how it is. Maybe you do too. When all those alerts and tickets start lighting up your monitor, kind of like a Christmas tree, you aren't being productive. You're just stressed out. That's no fun. No mere mortal can analyze all those alerts and respond to all those tickets. It's hard to keep it all straight. Good news, you can immediately reduce that noise with Moogsoft AI Ops. Moogsoft AI Ops is artificial intelligence for IT operations. It does a number of things for you. It makes your life easier, first of all, but it reduces your IT alerts and tickets by up to 90%, and that's guaranteed. It surfaces only actionable work items. They do this by clustering events into correlated situations so you don't have to look at another alert or another ticket ever again. Developed for the enterprise, it requires no rules, filters, or models to maintain, and it integrates with your existing tools, which is very nice. Moogsoft AI Ops has your back. It's not here to replace you, but rather make you the hero, kind of like a superhero in this sense. Through machine learning, Moogsoft AI Ops will lower the frequency and duration of repeat incidents so you can get back to doing what you do best and probably what you'd rather be doing. A whole lot of people are doing this and proving why it works. HCL Technologies, a global IT managed service provider, includes Moogsoft AI Ops as the event management layer within its award-winning Dry Ice platform. This has helped its clients streamline operational workflows, even reduce time in the detect to correct lifecycle of incident tickets. And HCL experienced a 33% reduction in mean time to restore, enabling them to support more customers with service quality and also keeping operational costs low and efficiency high, which is another big bonus. With Moogsoft AI Ops, you can reduce your IT alerts and tickets by up to 90%. Like I said, that's guaranteed. So you want to check it out for yourself. Visit Moogsoft.com moogsoft.com to get a demo. That's moogsoft.com, and we thank Moogsoft for their support of Security Now. All right, so what else? He's been busy. What else is Ron Wyden up to? And I, why are we still talking about Flash? It amazes me that this is still a topic in 2018, but it is. Here we are.
Unbelievable. it really is. So we've talked about how glad we are that Adobe is finally going to shoot it and just put it out of its misery.
Yes.
By the end of, but not like tomorrow. They're dragging it out to the end of 2020. So Ron Wyden has written another one of his letters, this time to, get this, the NIST, our U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology, the NSA, the National Security Agency, and the DHS, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. The letter asks those government officials in those departments to find solutions and procedures to mandate the removal of Adobe Flash content from all U.S. government websites by August 1st of 2019. Okay, so 1 year from today. So that makes it about a year and a half before its official end of life. And of course, we know that, as I said, Adobe is due to formally end of life Flash in 2020, after which they have said they would cease to provide any technical support for the software. Okay, Lord help us. it just needs to go away.
Yeah.
In his letter, well, and I mean, it can, because HTML5, you know, basically Flash now is only an old school media player. It used to be that, you know, games and puzzles and all kinds of stuff were run on Flash, because we didn't really have JavaScript as pervasive as we do now. We didn't have the web just didn't have the media handling, and especially the video playing capabilities. Well, all that's now available in every browser through HTML5. So it's only inertia. Again, it's only because Flash used to be what people were using that it's still there.
Well, what my question on that regard, you know, of it being inertia, like, okay, it was there. Are they still actively using it and updating it, or is it just like legacy Flash pieces? Because this isn't just about security. It's also about broken sites, because as users, we're not using Flash anymore. So we visit a site that has Flash, we're missing something, or even worse, it looks like, you know, garbage.
Well, and of course, iOS devices have never supported Flash.
Right. Oh,
that was one of Jobs' big issues, was he said, I refuse to support that on the iPhone or on the iPad. So, you know, it's always had a problem there. So Ron said in his letter, he said the federal government has too often failed to transition away from software that has been decommissioned. Actually, he referred to Windows XP, which the federal government is still using. And frankly, I have to say, I would be too if my XP machine hadn't died last month. But now I'm on Windows 7. I'm happy there. And he says, he points out that Flash's serious, and I love this, largely unfixable cybersecurity issues as one of the reasons U.S. government sites should take proactive steps to permanently remove this technology from all of its sites well before the cutoff date, after which, as he says, Adobe won't provide any security fixes at all. So he asks that government agencies not deploy new Flash-based content on any federal website within 60 days, that federal agencies remove all Flash-based content from their websites by a year from tomorrow, August 1st, 2019, and require agencies to remove Flash from desktop computers by that same date, by August 1st, 2019. So it is in decline. We know that. In this last February, Google's director of engineering said that the daily use by their Chrome users had dropped from 80%, that is, I should say, Chrome users who encountered at least one page containing Flash content per day had dropped from 80% of in 2014. So 4 years ago, four out of five Chrome users did encounter at least one page containing Flash content. Now that's 8%. So from 80% to 8% by the time he made this statement in February of this year. So, you know, way down. And there's a web technology survey site, W3Techs, said that only 4.9% of today's websites utilize Flash, which is down from 28.5% at the beginning of 2011. So that doesn't represent as much of a precipitous decline as Chrome's users have encountered. That is a factor of 10 drop. Here it's a factor of what, little like 5. But still, you know, it's clear that it's time for it to go. So I think, you know, what'll end up happening, I mean, it's been so deprecated that it must just be sort of abandoned sites that have not figured out by now that, boy, you know, we really, if we want our videos to play, we just got to move over to HTML5.
Yeah, I guess it must be painful to move your Flash content over because, you know, if a government site is still serving it up. Well, either that or there's a theme here.
Well, and if it's not, yeah, exactly. There is the we don't care theme.
Yes, exactly.
But you know, if it is active Flash content, then it may be they no longer have the source. They, you know, they lost the programmer. They've got this SWF thing that actually does some business logic in it. Mm-hmm. And someone's going to have to recode that in JavaScript, and that will take some resources. So I mean, it's certainly the case that there were other things than video that Flash was able to do. That's and true. So if there are sites that that have, you know, proprietary business logic written in Flash, well, sorry folks, that you're going to be SOL. I mean, there's no question that browsers will refuse and OSs will refuse to run Flash in a couple years. So, you know, minimize the pain by getting it done sooner rather than later.
I guess it's also a cautionary tale for anyone, you know, building a website or building a service around certain certain tools like that, right? You hinge so much of what you're offering to people on a certain piece of technology, and if and when it's deemed insecure or decides to go away, yeah, you're left footing the bill. But I guess that's just the world that we live in.
Well, 10 years ago, it probably made sense.
It was a good amount of time.
Yeah, there was no useful alternative back then. Sure. Now, you know, there is.
Absolutely is.
I did have in the notes, and I got off of the strict site isolation. I did want to mention that Firefox is also moving towards strict site isolation. They have a project that they call Fission, which, I don't know, it seems like the reverse of strict site isolation. But anyway, that's the name of the project. And it's intending to provide much stricter site isolation sandboxing, very much like what Chrome is doing, and bringing that to the Mozilla Firefox platform. So everyone's going to experiment with that. We'll hope that it doesn't become too burdensome on our systems, but it does look like giving each domain its own process would you know, be a useful increase in sandboxing security.
Yeah, and reading through that, what kind of was a little alarming was their example of showing just how much memory overhead they were getting right now, and the number's far too high. And when I think of Firefox as a browser, and it might be an outdated belief because I don't use Firefox on a daily basis necessarily, definitely not on mobile, a little bit on desktop, but I don't think of it as the most memory memory capable, let's say. You know, it always seems to kind of slow itself down in my experience with it. So that seems like a big hurdle for them to overcome here.
Yeah. there was an interesting piece in Bleeping Computer that sort of caught me up short, I guess. And I wanted to make sure I put it on our listeners' radar. And it's a problem. And that is that there is a trend now for the registration by third parties of legitimate domain names in other top-level domains. And Bleeping Computer's article covered specifically French and Spanish language versions of legitimate sites. KeyPass.fr, 7zip.fr, Inkscape.fr, gparted.fr, clonezilla.fr, audacity.es, clonezilla.es, handbrake.es, gimp.es, thunderbird.es, audacity.fr, clonezilla, and on and on. And what's happening is that, you know, these are not sites that are put up by the owners of the official .com domains. They normally do contain French and Spanish language translations of the legitimate sites, but they are offering adware laden downloads of those products of 7-Zip or KeyPass or gparted or clonezilla. So that, of course, the elevated danger beyond that is that they could also be offering fraudulent malware laden. At this point, they're not. What they're doing is they are wrapping them in adware installers, because the adware pays per installation. So these are legitimate looking, language specific websites using the second level domain of the legitimate site that's normally a .com domain, offering altered downloads which install components of software that the original providers don't have anything to do with and certainly don't want to be supporting. Just beware. I don't know. I mean, the problem is in this instance, all of these various sites were registered using the same email address. So it's one entity that has decided this is the way they're going to make money, is they're going to adware enhance legitimate software, create foreign language translations of the original English language .com sites under .fr and .es, which of course are French and Spanish respectively. So under those TLDs. And of course, some companies will take the time and effort to register the equivalent domain in every other TLD, which, I mean, it's one of the fundamental problems with the way the internet is structured is, what do you do about that? I mean, if you invest in a major trademark like GRC or like TWIT, well, you don't want some creep registering the same second level domain in a different TLD and drawing some traffic to their site under the belief that it's like related in some way to grc.com or twit.tv or google.anything else. So the tendency for a commercial company is to immediately also grab their main .com site name in all other TLDs and essentially just squat on them or grab them and then aim them all, you know, redirect them all to their primary authentic domain. But if you do that, then that kind of kills all the whole point of having individual, country-based TLDs. So the whole thing just sort of didn't evolve right. And I guess the way it should work is that an English language .com site could create an authentic French language .fr and Spanish language .es version of their own site, and then do it legitimately. But that's also a huge amount of work. And a lot of these are just open source sites. You know, they're .orgs or .nets. I mean, they're just, they don't have the resources. And by the way, you know, as we know, you have to pay annually for domain names. So if you go and grab your name in every TLD there is, suddenly your annual maintenance cost just jumps up, because you got to maintain the registration of those everywhere, and some of them are not as inexpensive as the .com variants. And there's a bizarre, I mean, there's like, they're constantly proliferating with there being more of them all the time. So it's a mess, and I don't see a good solution. The problem is, since they're legitimate registrations and they legitimately own the domain, they can get, you know, they can be using Let's Encrypt and have certificates and HTTPS and have Google Chrome say, yeah, this is a secure site. And if it looks legitimate, how would a user know that if it's a French translation of a .com with a valid certificate that looks right, how would they know not to download the software and in fact get this extra adware installed on their computer that they don't want to have? So anyway, I just wanted to sort of put it on everyone's radar, because it's a problem, and I don't see a solution.
Yeah, that sounds nasty. And it's not just the fact that you end up at the site and, you know, you see the TLD and everything checks out in your head, looks legit or whatever, but also fact that you install the app that you expected to install, and it's not like it's some, you know, wacky other thing.
Right.
It's exactly what you wanted. It just did this other stuff underneath. So, you know, even from that point on, you still kind of go on living your life, not thinking anything happened, because every single step of the way checked out.
Yep.
Seemingly, anyways. The article on Bleeping Computer mentioned something called VirusTotal as a service to upload files that you download from these things. Are you aware of that service? Is it like if you don't have a virus scanner on your computer, that's a way to run the file through to make sure it's legit?
Yeah, it's very cool. We have talked about it on the podcast. It's a service owned by Google, and you're able to, if you have the way it's mostly used is if you have a file that you feel a little sketchy about it, like, I'm not sure where this came from. I found this on a thumb drive, or a friend gave it to me, or something. It's free, and what it does is, I don't remember how many there are. There's like 70 or 80. What it does is it passes the file through every AV solution in the industry and shows you how many of them think that there's something sketchy about it. And so it's very cool. You can also do it with URLs. So like, is this a sketchy site URL? It'll evaluate those. For a while, I was with Squirrel, the Windows Defender was like taking a while and scrutinizing my Squirrel client deeply. And so I kept putting versions of it up on VirusTotal, and it turned out, you know, I just built it fresh. I knew that there was nothing weird in it. It turns out it was just the reputation. It hadn't earned a reputation because it was so new. And that behavior all went away, and now there's no delay. But VirusTotal is a very cool solution, and available for free.
Yeah. Yeah, there it is. Nice to know about that. I didn't realize that existed. Awesome stuff. This next one I've been very curious about Google's kind of Play Store rules, and that involves cryptocurrency mining now.
Well, yeah, and you know, for a while, I mean, cryptocurrency mining is, you know, on the outs, obviously.
Yeah.
it's the whole idea of mal mining or cryptojacking, stealing someone's processor time has been problematical. It's a bigger problem on smartphones, because although smartphones are balanced to allow the processor to burst when necessary to get some work done, they assume most of the time the processor is going to drop to a more or less idle, low power state. Of course, that's antithetical to cryptocurrency mining that wants to just go balls to the wall and, you know, squeeze as much processing out of the any processor and GPU that it can find. So there have been instances of devices truly being destroyed by malicious mining on them. Batteries overheat. Cases expand, gases are produced, the cases break, are deformed, the batteries leak, all kinds of stuff. So over time we've been seeing Google sort of incrementally putting the screws to cryptocurrency mining. For a while, the intermediate step was that as long as the mining was not deceptive, that is, as long as an app said, "Hi, I'm John's, Ethereum miner. Download me and plug your phone in, because otherwise I'm going to drain your battery. Let's mine some Ethereum." I mean, when an app was right up front, Google said, "Well, okay, if the user wants to do that, then fine." Whereas the mining that did it surreptitiously in the background, those had been officially banned and were removed whenever they were found. Well, what happened just now is Google has changed their policy. They have now, in their Developer Policy Center, which is a long, comprehensive document about all the things, and it's a growing list of things that apps are not allowed to do, all kinds of deceptive stuff and pretending to be one thing and being another. Basically the list is growing because Google wants to have a basis for rejecting things from the Play Store and say, look, there you're in violation of our policy. So what just appeared under the Developer Policy Center, under a new section that was added called Financial Instruments, they said, "We don't allow apps that expose users to deceptive or harmful financial instruments." And then they said, "We do not allow apps that provide users with the ability to trade binary options." And specifically under cryptocurrencies, they said, "We don't allow apps that mine cryptocurrency on devices, period." They said, "We permit apps that remotely manage the mining of cryptocurrency." So this is a change. So even a Play Store app that is, as I was mentioning before, is right up front and like telling it like it is, sorry, that's no longer the case. They did not notify anyone of these changes. They did not publicly pre-announce this. So there were developers who had apps removed who were complaining on Reddit about this, but Google said, "Sorry, we made a policy change. We're no longer going to allow any cryptocurrency mining at all to be sold through or made or offered through the Google Play Store." So I suppose you could still sideload if you wanted to in order to get things onto your device, but it's probably a bad idea.
Yeah, and if you're mining cryptocurrency, there's probably some sort of Venn diagram between like cryptocurrency on mobile miners and people who are comfortable sideloading apps. There's probably a big overlap there. You know what I mean?
So yes,
I'm sure it'll be all right. I'm sure they'll be okay. But this is good news. I think for Google to do this, they're not alone. Apple did this very recently as well.
Last
Google's
month.
Been blocking this from Chrome extensions in the web store. So yeah, this makes sense.
Yeah, it was time, and I think it was clearly something that, the handwriting was on the wall that this was not going to be allowed to continue.
Yeah.
We've talked also about in the past about supply chain attacks. And this is sort of worrisome. One that occurred recently was an app that Leo's not a big fan of, but actually I am. A Sea Cleaner got a version of itself infected for the, like the actual website for Sea Cleaner was attacked, and the download for Sea Cleaner was altered. I don't remember now what malicious was put into it. It might have been file encrypting malware, or might have been a cryptocurrency miner. But you know, it was found and fixed quickly. But the point is that there, people were legitimately downloading a, you know, from the Sea Cleaner site, an app that was not what it appeared to be in a so-called supply chain attack. Microsoft, in their cloud blogs, talked about their discovery of a recent supply chain attack, which Bleeping Computer covered. And I'm just going to share what Bleeping Computer wrote because it's a nice summary. Microsoft's write-up, if anyone is interested, I have a link in the show notes and it is much longer. Bleeping Computer did a nice summary. They said, Microsoft said today that hackers compromised a font package installed by a PDF editor app and used it to deploy a cryptocurrency miner on users' computers. The OS maker, meaning Microsoft, discovered the incident after its staff received alerts via the Windows Defender ATP, the commercial version of the Windows Defender antivirus. Microsoft employees say they investigated the alerts and determined that attackers breached the cloud server infrastructure of a software company providing font packages as MSI files. That's the Microsoft installer format. These MSI files were offered to other software companies. One of these downstream companies was using these font packages for its PDF editor app, which would download the MSI files from the original company's cloud servers during the editor's installation routine. But hackers created a copy of the company's cloud servers. Microsoft security researchers said that attackers created the first company's infrastructure, duplicating it on a replica server that the attackers owned and controlled. They copied and hosted all MSI files, including font packages, all clean and digitally signed in the replica server. Then the attackers decompiled and modified one MSI file, which was an Asian fonts pack, to add the malicious payload with the bit mining code. Using an unspecified weakness, which they said did not appear to be a man in the middle or a DNS hijack, the attackers were able to influence the downstream parameters used by the PDF editor app. That's the one which was then following up and downloading the font packages. The parameters included a new download link that pointed to the attacker's server. Users who downloaded and ran the PDF editor app would unknowingly install the font packages, including the malicious one, from the hacker's cloned server. Because the PDF editor app was installed under system privileges, the malicious coin miner code hidden inside would receive full access to a user's system. So actually, it was sort of fortuitous and lucky that all it wanted to do was to mine cryptocurrency and not get up to more mischief. The malicious miner would create its own process named Xbox-service.exe, under which it would mine for cryptocurrencies using the victim's computers. And I was thinking about that. I mean, if you looked into why your system suddenly was running slower and then checked with process monitor and saw that Xbox-service.exe was using up a lot of processor, well, maybe you'd think, oh, well, okay, maybe it's supposed to. You know, I mean, a lot of people aren't going to know. Microsoft said Windows Defender ATP detected mining-specific behavior from this process. Investigators then tracked down the origin of the process to the PDF editor app installer and the MSI font packages. Security researchers said it was easy to identify which MSI font package was the malicious one because all the other MSI files were digitally signed by the original software company except that one file, which lost its authenticity when the crooks injected their coin miner code into it. So anyway, this is another problem that we're seeing in various forms, the supply chain attack, where users are being as responsible and cautious as possible, where they are visiting a site whose security looks good. It's got its certificates intact. Everything looks copacetic. They download an installer which looks like it's doing a legitimate job. It's signed, it's working correctly. But once the PDF, in this case PDF viewer or whatever the app that was installed by the installer runs, it then reaches out and flushes itself out. At that point, it's going to a different, to this cloned network, and we don't know how it was pointed to a different service, but it was, and downloaded this altered font package among all the font packages which installed the cryptocurrency miner. So, the problem is everything was done right by the end user, yet they still got a cryptocurrency miner in their system. So again, running as system, where the malware could have done anything it wanted to. So I don't know how someone would protect themselves from this. It's certainly beyond the expectation of an end user to like. Well, actually, I mean, the app you've installed is just going out and doing stuff on the network, and you trust it because it was secured by the installer, and the installer was secured by the download. The download was secured by the certificate of the site you went to. So an intact chain of trust, yet you still got a cryptocurrency miner in you. So, this is a fruitful attack, and I have no doubt we'll be seeing more of them in the future.
And when a computer has been co-opted like that, there's a cryptocurrency miner happening active in the background. Like, what does the user of the computer actually notice? Do they notice any sort of slowdown? I mean, that's not light work that's happening, or I don't know, is it?
It's very light. It is. Yeah, well, no, it is normally very heavy.
Yeah.
Because the cryptocurrency miner wants to use as much of the system's resources as possible.
Right.
So one of the things but the cryptocurrency miner also wants to remain undiscovered to whatever degree is possible. It doesn't want to have it's like itself removed. So, by drawing attention to itself. Mm-hmm. So what normally happens is, and we've talked about this in the past, they are beginning to be a little foxier about when they use the system. Like they'll notice if the system is idle and for example, use all of the CPU, but use it at the lowest priority possible so that other things that need to running at normal priority will be able to preempt the cryptocurrency miner, yet it'll still suck up all the slack time. Or it may wait for a period of inactivity, wait so that there actually is an API call that is notify on system inactivity, where some period of time of no mouse and keyboard use has occurred. So then it figures, I'm still running, but the user has walked away. So, now's a good time to do some mining.
Yeah.
And then the second the user touches the mouse or types something, the miner will suspend itself again, not wanting to give away the fact that it's there.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Interesting. Yeah, I definitely see more of that for sure.
Yeah. So Titan security keys. This was big news last week. Google launched their own USB and Bluetooth-based FIDO. That's the Fast Identity Online, F-I-D-O. FIDO U2F, which is the Universal Second Factor Protocol. Hardware tokens. Of course, we're all familiar with the equivalent from YubiKey, which is actually the company that I'm probably responsible for discovering. Stina tells everybody that it was this podcast, which occurred a couple of weeks after a significant RSA conference. I happened to be attending the RSA conference for the podcast with press credentials, and Stina was there standing at the top of an escalator looking around for some press people, and she asked me if I was interested in authentication, and I said yeah, and I didn't know how much I was interested, but I mean it had been a constant topic of ours for the podcast. We talked about the little eBay and PayPal football that generated the three or the six character changing one-time password token. Anyway, so she explained that she had a little thing that was that emulated a USB keyboard, and it produced a one-time password, and every time you touched it, it spit out a different string that was cryptographically secure. And I gasped, because it was such a clever and cool idea to use this little tiny fob as a USB keyboard. It meant it needed no drivers. You could just put the cursor in a field and touch it, and it would type this crypto string into a browser form, and then off you go. The first chunk of digits was not changing. That was its ID, and the second longer string was a one-time password, which changed every time. So I mean, it was beautiful. And 3 weeks, I think, or so later, I did the entire podcast on the YubiKey, explaining how it worked and what it did. And Stina, I guess she has some presentation someone pointed me to years ago, where she said, yeah, we got put on the map thanks to Security Now, which was very cool.
That's awesome.
So they've been, they have been the hardware dongle provider of choice. And I don't know what their relationship to Google is. I know that they've worked with Google, that Google have had lots of YubiKeys in the past. And so I don't know if this has been done in conjunction with Google, or if Google just decided they wanted something different or go in a different direction than Yubico. But so this is something like that. I did give Yubico a full presentation on my solution, Squirrel, last November, and sat down with Stina and three other techies, I mean, like the crypto techies, ran through the whole thing, answered all of their questions, and they were very interested. They're basically just waiting for me to get this thing done. And if it gets traction, they're very interested in doing a squirrel-based hardware token of the same ilk as what they've done before, because Squirrel, it can absolutely have the user's private, super secret one private key put into a piece of hardware to protect it from any possibility of theft. And I've gotten a lot of questions, not surprisingly, as time has gone on with AuthN and FIDO and so forth, about how Squirrel and FIDO are different. And I will certainly address that in a document to, you know, put them side by side. One of the things I will say is that it is that FIDO is by its nature and even by its name, you know, U2F, universal second factor. What it is not is a first factor. And that's probably one of the biggest differences is that what squirrel is a secure one factor. That is, it identifies you and authenticates that identity. None of these second factor things are able to identify you. They have to know who you are claiming to be first because they store your credentials on the server. So the server has to send the credentials back to you for you to then authenticate against those credentials. So it's a small thing, but it makes a big difference in the login flow, because with Squirrel, you don't have to identify yourself. You just click the login with Squirrel button and you're done. So and there's a lot more too. Squirrel has what we call complete life cycle management, where it's able to handle identity life cycle management, where if a bad guy gets your Squirrel key, malware gets into your phone where you're storing it, or something happens, or you were to lose it, there is a provision for locking down your identity and securely recovering your identity and managing it over the long term, none of which is built into FIDO. That's considered all like per site. Each site will handle that individually. So when it's finally done, when I get Squirrel's authentication working on the Squirrel public web forums, then it'll be time to officially announce and launch this. And there is an Android client, an iOS client, web extension. There's a native Linux client, Java, a PHP support server side, Java server side code. So there's a lot of other stuff going on that I'll be talking about in the meantime. And right now, the Google Cloud users are able to get these Titan security keys. They are said to be available widely through the Google Store at some point in the future. And I look forward to learning a little more about what's going on behind the scenes with these. Are they, you know, are they actually being manufactured by Yubico and privately branded, or what? I don't know.
Or completely removed from Yubico. I guess Google's been had its employees, all 85,000 of them, using these types of security keys since 2017. They've said that there've been no account takeovers since they put that requirement in place. So it'd be interesting if they were using the Yubico keys all that time, and they're like, "All right, we got what we needed. Now we have our own. See you later." I don't know that. Hopefully, there's some sort of a relationship there.
Yeah.
But that's cool. I want to get one myself and check it out.
Yeah, sounds cool. So I did get a nice note on the topic of SpinRite, which I try to share with our users every week when I can, from Joshua Montgomery, who's in Springfield, Illinois. The subject was SpinRite saved one of our ATMs. He sent this on the 26th of July. He said, "Steve, I've been an avid listener since the beginning of Security Now. Thanks to you and Leo for all of your hard work." He says, "I wanted to thank you for making this splendid product. It saved my neck. We had a very high traffic ATM hard drive fail. The tech said they could not make it for 48 hours. He says, "I pulled the hard drive from the ATM and ran SpinRite on it. It fixed enough of the drive that I could clone it to an SSD within 3 hours. Now we have one of the fastest ATM machines in the North. Keep up the good work, Joshua."
That's got to feel good to get a message like that.
I get them huge all the time, and I really do love it to be able to, you know, just like, here, SpinRite just fixes the drive, and then, oh no, off people go again.
Yeah, from 48 hours to 3 hours, no big deal.
That's especially on a high traffic ATM. Yeah. Apparently, it was like really important.
Yeah, you don't want any downtime on something like that. That's people's money, including your own.
Yep.
So tell me a little bit about Bluetooth, because I'm like late to the game on Bluetooth, at least when it comes to headphones anyways. I mean, I have Bluetooth devices that I use on a regular basis, but I've been reluctant to use Bluetooth over the years just because I find it, you know, not as dependable. Dropouts, there's always the kind of potential for security risk, you know, depending on what's going over, and this definitely ties into that.
Well, and you got to keep them charged. Yeah. And so there's that also. And, you know, and I'm a little concerned about the health risks. I mean, you're sticking a radio in your ear canal.
That's true.
And it's like, let other people do that. I just think I'd rather not do that myself. But Bluetooth, of course, has lots of other applications. It's become, because it is high speed and low power, and it's sort of got a nice range compromise. You know, NFC is deliberately like contact near field radio. And of course, Wi-Fi is deliberately long range radio. Bluetooth sort of fits right there in the middle. And at 30 feet or 10 meters as the official distance. And then there are some, like, you know, some extended distances. But it has always been... there's always been a vulnerability. In fact, the research paper, which was published and will be given, is titled "Breaking the Bluetooth Pairing: Fixed Coordinate Invalid Curve Attack." And our listeners have heard me say many times in the past that the only way I think it is secure to pair Bluetooth devices is to walk out into the middle of a large parking lot, which, like, on a Sunday morning when it's empty, or maybe go into the middle of a football stadium. That is, physically isolate yourself from the environment and do the pairing, because Bluetooth pairing is the moment of vulnerability. That's when there is stuff happening that is the devices finding each other and exchanging cryptographic material and deciding, like agreeing upon a secret key, which they will then use for everything else. That's the weakness. That's the moment of maximum vulnerability. Now, the protocol works to minimize that. There's all this, you know, each side displays a 6-digit code to the other, or one side has a screen and the other side has a key. And so you enter the number that one side is showing. The idea is, They're trying to use an out-of-band communication, that is, a visual, real-world communication outside of the radio band. But there are many instances where you don't have that luxury. You've got, like, an IoT device. You know, it's a door lock, or, well, a door lock might have a keypad, so that's a bad example. But like a sliding window lock, where it's just a little magnet that is going to use a Bluetooth connection to the home hub, and it doesn't have anything. So pairing has always been problematical. And so the spec over time has evolved through Bluetooth, well, up to 4.0 and 4.2, continually working to improve the pairing technology. So the crypto used in the latest Bluetooth is elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, ECDH, which is an evolution of the original RSA-style Diffie-Hellman, which is really a cool technology. We've talked about this before. This is a key agreement protocol, which even though it's like hard to imagine, two parties can exchange data in the clear, that is, can publicly exchange some information with each other. And even though a third party can capture all of their interaction, those first two parties are able to securely agree upon a secret, which the third party, despite seeing all of their conversation, cannot obtain. So it's just, it's very cool. And it's one of the fundamental architectures for cryptography. And elliptic curve is being used today because it allows much shorter keys. And that ends up being important. The packet length, for example, for Bluetooth low energy is, I think it's 16 bits, or it's very, very small. So maybe it's 16 bytes. Anyway, it's very small. So it's impractical to exchange a large key in a Bluetooth low energy environment. You really want the key to be shorter. And the computational power of these little devices is really reduced. So that's why elliptic curve is where everybody is going moving forward. Okay, so what's this attack? The short version is it is nothing to worry about. What these guys discovered is an active attack where there should not be one, but it does require that an attacker be involved in the pairing, be able to intercept and modify some of the traffic that is being exchanged. What the current spec fails to do is to authenticate one of the parameters that is being exchanged. In elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, the private side of the public and private key pair. The private side is a large scalar number, which is kept secret. The public side is a coordinate on the elliptic curve, which is exchanged as, you know, an X and a Y. It turns out that the protocol only requires, the protocol only requires that the X coordinate of the X and Y coordinate pair, which form the public side of the public-private key, is validated. And what these attackers discovered is if they can arrange to get themselves in a position to somehow zero the Y coordinate of the XY coordinate point on the curve with a 50% probability in some cases, or a 25% probability in most cases, they're able to decrypt the private key that these guys and that they valid that the two valid endpoints end up negotiating. Thus, the reason that I don't think this is a big deal. So it's like only in the event of the pairing, only if an attacker can actually intercept and alter by zeroing some of the data being exchanged, can this even be done. And even then, with a 25 or maybe 50% chance of determining what the private key is that is negotiated between the parties. And in the other case, they're having zeroed the Y coordinate causes the agreement to fail. So they're either able to get the key that the parties negotiate, or the Bluetooth pairing fails, which would cause it to get, you know, to be redone until it succeeds, which would suggest they're ultimately able to obtain the private key. But I don't know how. I mean, in practical terms, an attacker gets themselves in a position where they're able to prevent the recipient at each end, because it's an exchange, to prevent the recipient from receiving the proper coordinate. So you'd have to have directional antennas aimed at each of the devices being paired. You'd have to, for also Bluetooth, remember, is also a frequency hopping spread spectrum technology. So you have to lock onto the frequency hopping and know which frequency each side is going to be transmitting to the other on. That's now doable, but still it's more involved. You then presumably have to flood the recipient with a radio saturation attack to prevent it from receiving the valid data from the other side, then stop flooding it and then send it the altered data, which you would have received from the other side while it was trying to send it to the side that you were flooding, then alter that by zeroing the Y coordinate and then forward it on to the side that you had just flooded, and then do the entire same thing immediately to the other side. So it's like, holy Toledo.
So Steve, you're saying then that there's a chance that it could happen.
Yes. This is like, okay.
Yeah, it sounds like a long way to go.
Yeah, it's a and so it is a vulnerability. It is there. It is theoretical. It could happen, you know, if like all the planets align correctly and somehow a bad guy like is desperate to do this and has the technology and is present during the event of pairing. I mean, maybe there is and I can't think of what it would be, like a high value system which is going to be pairing over Bluetooth at a known time and place, and a bad guy could set up in order to like intercept it, that would be high enough value to be worth doing. But I really can't imagine the scenario. So the attackers have looked at different systems. They did find that the Android Bluetooth stack, BlueDroid, is vulnerable, whereas Windows is not, because it does not support the low energy SC pairing that is vulnerable. The vulnerability in there is a protocol, SSP, Secure Simple Pairing. The vulnerability in SSP depends upon the blue chip firmware implementation, since the handshake is performed in the chip rather than by the host. They said that during their research, they found that the devices of most chip vendors are affected. Qualcomm's, Broadcom's, and Intel's implementations are vulnerable, which they said together constitute most of the Bluetooth chip market. So they said, we stress that every device, mobile phone, laptop, or car that uses such a chip is vulnerable. On the other hand, I would stress that it really doesn't matter, because, you know, think about this. Our listeners should know that there's this chance. It is also the case that everybody is scrambling to fix this. So the Android will get an update.
I think they already did. I believe it may have been in the June security patch. But then again, it's part of the patch. Who has the patch? You know, that's the conundrum that Android users are always in.
Yes.
Like Google did something about it and they included it in their security update. But did you ever get that update? Probably not.
Yep. So there was a lot of furor in the press about, you know, oh my God, Bluetooth is vulnerable to hacking during pairing. It's like, yeah.
Technically so.
Theoretically.
Right.
And anyway, so, and the fix, it turns out, is simple. If the Y coordinate is zeroed, then the public side of the public key pair, which is supposed to be a point on the curve, will be invalid. So all anybody has to do is what they maybe should have always done, which is verify that the public point they receive from the other side is a valid point on the curve. They're not doing that. So that's all they have to do. So fixing it is not a big problem. It'll generate a next rev of the spec, which will require it because now we know, oops, you know, maybe there's some chance of it being compromised, and we don't want that to be the case because we all want Bluetooth to be secure. So it'll be even more secure. I think it's fine just the way it is with this bizarre caveat that, okay, there's a theoretical way that the handshake could be intercepted that would, with some probability of 25 or 50%, allow the bad guy to negotiate, you know, or to watch, you know, to recover the private key that both guys end up with. But wow.
Far cry from Blueborn, which I believe was the Bluetooth virus that we heard about last year.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Steve, got any other things that aren't included in this list that you want to kind of finish things off with? I know, obviously, GRC.com, but I don't want to start the close of the show yet until I know for
You've got it
all in. It's all in there.
My work here is finished.
Your memory dump is done. It's over. And I really appreciate it. GRC.com. I know everybody listening and watching appreciate it too. Anybody who wants to catch all of the stuff that Steve is up to, go to GRC.com. Obviously, you talked about SpinRite, the best hard drive recovery and maintenance tool. You can get your copy there. Information about Squirrel, audio and video of this show. You're hosting that on that site as well as transcripts, right?
Yep. Yep, exactly.
Right on. People can find all that there. twit.tv/SN if you want to go to our site. And you can, of course, find all the audio and video there. Subscribe to the podcast, Security Now. Do a search for Security Now in any of the podcatchers that you're using. You're going to find it. Search for Twit or Security Now, and you'll definitely come across that. And then, of course, we have a live chat room. We've got a live stream. We do this show every Tuesday at 1:30 p.m. Pacific, 4:30 p.m. Eastern, 20:30 UTC. If you go to twit.tv/live, you can tune in and watch as the show is recorded and participate in chat. And everybody's always talking about, a number of the security topics. Everybody kind of expands on the topics of the day. And it's a lot of fun to participate in that way as well. Steve, I always appreciate having the chance to do a podcast with you. So thank you for allowing me to be your cohort today. I really appreciate
it. Likewise, and I won't see you next week or for a few weeks, but then you're going to be back for a run of three. So
that'll
be great. We will have more of the Jason Steve team in September.
Right on. I'm looking forward to it. That's right. That's in September. So Leo will be out then, and I will see you then. But next week, Leo and Steve will be back for another episode. So make sure you don't miss it of Security Now. Take care, everybody.
Thanks, Jason. Bye. Security.